This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have five bills on the agenda. We'll begin with Senate File 184. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 184 is a bill that tries to make a significant effort to increase our family planning services in the state of Minnesota. Family planning services are a very critically important aspect of public health in this state and in every state, and it's something that is a wonderful thing for prevention of unintended pregnancies, heavy use of family planning, making it widely available to people across the state, will prevent unintended pregnancies, reduces the number of abortions, significantly can reduce sexually transmitted infections, and there have been a number of studies around the country, the most conservative of which has suggested for every dollar we spend on family planning services saves taxpayers almost $4, $3.80. Almost a 4-to-1 payback. That's the most conservative of the studies in terms of the taxpayer savings from unintended pregnancies, because a whole lot of the expenses, I think a majority of our MFIP expenses go to families that start out with a teenage pregnancy. And so this bill is one that would start moving us back to where we were at one point under about a decade ago. We had significantly higher amount spent on family planning services, about $10 million. And at that time, family plan contraceptives were much less expensive. They've had a sharp increase in prices in recent years, and a lot of the clinics are struggling to provide the services. And on top of that, the state has cut back on the amount of funding. So the need has increased, the cost has gone up, and the amount of money available has gone down. I'll go through the bill quickly, and then we do have a number of witnesses who are going to speak to the issue. And the goal here is, again, that family planning services would be available to people throughout the state of Minnesota, regardless of ability to pay, because there are many people who the cost of contraception is enough of a barrier that they do not use it because of that. Anyway, Section 1 is spelling out some of the benefits of family planning services. The cost of it and the savings we get by it. Section 2 of the bill would allow, and there is an amendment here that maybe I should offer at this time as an author's amendment. I have the A1 amendment, which I believe is in your packets. I'd like to make a change on page 1.9. It's supposed to be page 3, delete Section 6. Madam Chair, I'd move that to put the bill in the shape I'd like the bill.
Okay. Members, all of those in favor of incorporating this change into the amendment, please say aye.
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 All of those opposed? So the amendment carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Section 2, which has now been amended, this is just to clarify what a family planning agency is, but this would allow a registered nurse in a family planning agency to dispense oral contraceptives. Right now, you have to be an advanced practice nurse in order to do so. Again, we're required to be subject to dispensing protocol established by the medical director and under the direction of a physician. But that would make it much easier, especially in greater Minnesota, where it's not always easily realistic to get an advanced practice nurse available to dispense the prescription. Section 3 would be an attempt to increase in family planning reimbursement by a 25% rate increase for community clinics. Section 4 is an attempt to include nonprofit community health clinics in the state's multi-state contracting pharmaceutical alliance. Section 5 is also, I believe, in Senate File 2 that we passed out of here and in a bill of Senator Pretner Solens as well. This would undo a cut in the family planning base funding from a couple of years ago, which would have cut the amount of family planning grants by half. This is restoring that, avoiding that cut. Section 6 we just deleted from the bill. Section 7 of the bill would require the Commission of Human Services to work with the clinics to adjust the MA reimbursement rates to adequately cover the cost of doing business. Again, a lot of these clinics are struggling to survive. And Section 8 of the bill would be an $8 million increase in the general, from the general fund to the Commissioner of Health. And obviously, this is going to be a significant budget issue. But if we provide this funding, we will be back to where we were at one point and would be able to provide the services to people in the state that need it. And again, it's a big savings in cost through MFIP and our medical assistance programs because of the savings from preventing unintended pregnancies. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a number of witnesses who were going to speak to the bill. To start by calling Wendy Halberstadt. She's testifying. Maybe I'll call up Mac Baird, Dr. Mac Baird.
Thank you. I have some data documenting my testimony. And
welcome to the committee, Mrs. Halberstadt. Could you please introduce yourself to the members and proceed with your testimony? Thank you.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Wendy Hellerstedt. I'm an associate professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Public Health Association, so I'll speak on behalf of them as well. I'm very happy to speak in favor of Senate File 184. The CDC identified family planning as one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. In the first half of the century, education and services in family planning resulted in dramatic reduction in family size and dramatic improvements in infant and maternal mortality. More recently, since the introduction of modern contraceptives in the 1970s and the first federal family planning program, we've seen further reductions in maternal and infant mortality, a decrease in average family size from 4 children to 2, and a later age at birth for women. Also, since the 1970s and likely related, we've seen a doubling in the number of women who have achieved college educations and a 40% increase in the number of women in the labor force. Importantly, we've also seen a narrowing and maybe an elimination of racial and economic disparities in family planning. We know that the funds identified by this bill will provide education and outreach as well as services. Minnesotans have used family planning monies widely and broadly across the state to provide community-relevant programs. In 2004, Minnesota's family planning special projects provided education and outreach to almost 78,000 men and women, counseling to 35,000 men and women, and method services to about 25,000 people. These projects focus on priority populations, people who are least likely to have access to information and services. In 2004, these projects served the poorest Minnesotans. 75% of their clients lived at less than 200% of the federal poverty level. 84% of their clients were adults, and 41% identified as racial minorities. It's estimated that Minnesota's family planning projects helped avert 22,000 pregnancies and 11,000 abortions in 2004. So because of our wonderful use of family planning funds, we need to continue our prevention efforts, and there are sort of three big reasons. One, data from the National Survey of Family Growth tell us that the majority of men and women in the United States desire 2 children, and they want to have their babies closely spaced in about a 4 to 5 year period, and they want them in their mid to late 20s. This means that men and women will spend most of their fertile years avoiding pregnancy. For an average woman, that's about 30 years of needing family planning. Number 2, about half of the pregnancies in Minnesota are mistimed or unwanted. That's about 38,000 pregnancies, and 41% of them will terminate in abortion. Most of these unintended pregnancies are the result of failure to use family planning or inefficient use of family planning, and that speaks to the importance of funds for education, counseling, and follow-up. And finally, healthy pregnancies result in healthy babies. It's best that women enter their pregnancies in optimal health, and family planning is a way to prepare for pregnancy. To optimize their health, women may need to lose or gain weight prior to pregnancy. They may have to deal with addictions to narcotics, to nicotine or alcohol, very difficult to address while they're pregnant, or get chronic diseases like diabetes in good control. Men and women depend on family planning to emotionally and financially prepare for parenthood. So for all of those reasons, I want to express my strong support and the support of the Minnesota Public Health Association for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions from the committee? If not, we'll move to your next witness, please.
My name is Dr. Mac Beard. I'm professor and head of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota. I'm also actually a chairman of the board of UCARE, but I'm not speaking on behalf of UCARE. And I'm on the board for the Community University Health Center, Cook Clinic, which does receive funds from this source, and I'm not speaking for them. I'm speaking as an individual. We have, as a department, training programs all over the state. We have 47 RPAP, Rural Physician Associate students, out for 9 months, scattered around Minnesota. We have residencies around the metro area in St. Cloud and Mankato. So we actually have a good view of what's going on statewide through various clinical educational programs. And much as we've just heard from Wendy, there are many things that are needed to have a community have excellent health. Among them are contraceptive services. Our resident students and practicing clinicians take care of both the good side of pregnancies and the complications, and when pregnancies go awry, as well as when they're not desired. And we haven't spoken about the social consequences of unwanted pregnancies today, but they are vast and sometimes not easily recognized. So I speak on behalf of the bill, both for helping nurses dispense medications that are under the supervision of physicians that lead these clinics, as well as for the improved access to healthcare services of this nature that these clinics provide. And without increased funding, we're actually going backwards in having less access and less available resources, even for funded clinics, if they aren't able to dispense these medications in a timely manner when they're needed. So rather than go on, I just say that I'm personally in favor of this bill and its several dimensions, including the amendment, and that our physicians in training are part of the workforce that helps manage the pregnancies, both wanted and unwanted. And if they were here, I have a feeling that they could be a long line of people supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Beard. Are there any questions from the committee members? Thank you. Senator Marty, do you have your next witness?
Next witness is Sarah Stace, president of Planned Parenthood of Minnesota and North and South Dakota.
Welcome, Ms. Stace. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Stace. I'm the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood for Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak in favor of this very important bill. Thank you. In Minnesota, Planned Parenthood operates 24 clinics across our state, and we serve nearly 60,000 women and men in those clinics every year, providing basic reproductive health care services to them, primarily family planning. As you are well aware, and as our previous speakers have already said, family planning plays a fundamental role in helping men and women plan for and prepare for when they are financially and emotionally ready to have children. And in this manner, family planning contributes, of course, to society's overall health, and it's also fundamentally important to helping women and families avoid poverty by planning their childbearing. The Minnesota Department of Health stipulates in writing that while many unintended pregnancies result in healthy children born to healthy families, quote, unintended pregnancies are also associated with economic hardship, marital disillusion, poor child health and development, spouse abuse, and child abuse and neglect. In Minnesota, more than 260,000 women are in need of publicly supported contraceptive services, and the state's publicly funded family planning clinics are only able to see about 40% of those women. And this is true even though more than half of Minnesota's MFIP spending goes to families that began with a teenage mother. As a result, a recent study has shown that poor women are more than four times more likely to have an unintended pregnancy than women who are of higher income. In addition, sexually transmitted infections have reached their highest level ever in the state. Common sense dictates, and numerous peer-reviewed studies have shown that public investment in family planning makes good fiscal sense. For every dollar spent on family planning in Minnesota, a savings of $3.80 is realized. Nonetheless, it doesn't surprise you, I know, to hear that federal and state funding for family planning has not kept up with the cost of providing services, and consequently, Planned Parenthood has undertaken significant fundraising efforts to help close the gap between public funding and public need, although it is increasingly difficult for us to do that with each passing year. As you know, the primary source of state subsidized family planning services in Minnesota has been the Family Planning Special Projects Program, FPSP. And nonetheless, despite significant cost savings to Minnesota, funding for FPSP has gone down, as you've heard, quite dramatically. I just want to take a minute also to express my support for and concerns about the Medicaid Family Planning Waiver. This program allows an expanded group of low-income patients, those up to 200% of poverty, to enroll in Medicaid for Family Planning Services, which is great. But it's important to know that the federal government enacted this very important waiver program as a means to supplement, not supplant or replace, the existing state family planning programs. And while Planned Parenthood is eager to promote a broad, very broad implementation of the waiver program, there are many challenges with it. Most notably, the program is not computerized, and the staff at the State Department of Human Services are forced to hand process all of the applications. Furthermore, undocumented people are not eligible for the program, and this also tends to affect legal immigrants, many of whom have a lot of difficulty in gathering the proper documentation for enrollment. Additionally, patients who come to the clinic seeking testing for sexually transmitted infections, which is not, they're not a family planning visit, but a visit for something else, are not eligible to receive services under this waiver. And lastly, the Medicaid reimbursement rates for family planning are exceedingly low and often at less than 50% of costs. Centers for Disease Control has designated family planning as, quote, one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century, and I urge you to continue to support family planning by voting for Senate File 184. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Stace. Are there any questions for Ms. Stace? Thank you. Thank you. Senator Marty.
I next have Peg LeBoer from Family.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today. I'm the executive director of Family Tree Clinic in St. Paul, and I'm also the current statewide chair of the Statewide Association of Family Planning Providers called Safe Plan. I'm your reality check. I'd like to give you a little brief real-world facts from a clinic's perspective about the cost of running a clinic that serves low-income, uninsured people while trying to use the 1115 waiver, or what is now called the Minnesota Family Planning Program, which we go MFPP. Under the eligibility for MFPP, almost everyone on levels 1, 2, and 3 of Family Tree sliding fee scale will be eligible. That's about 70% of my clients to apply for this new program. From a consumer standpoint, MFPP really improves access to quality medical care, education, and referral services for the uninsured. Plus, patients can get free birth control supplies once granted MFPP status. Given the current market cost of birth control pills, which are somewhere between $33 and $44 a cycle per month, access to supplies is a critical need to prevent unintended pregnancies in all population groups. By the way, Safe Plan wishes to compliment DHS for their efforts to eliminate the backlog of MFPP applications. We believe they are now processing applications from mid-January. This is a tremendous improvement from a few months ago. From a provider perspective, MFPP is a financial train wreck waiting to happen. Current reimbursement rates for basic family planning services are at best equal to approximately 40% of Family Tree's costs. For an example, a new patient under 18 years of age costs Family Tree $160 a year for your annual exam. The waiver pays us between $36.53 and $43.82. We get reimbursed at the higher rate if the patient is seen by a physician. If it's a physician extender, we get paid at the lower rate. Our write-off is over 70% of our costs. For an established patient, the reimbursement rate is between $46.79 and $51.98. Again, nowhere near the needed $160. Our lowest write-off is when we do a colposcopy with a biopsy, where we only lose 37% of our costs. It will be impossible for clinics like Family Tree to stay in business if most clients gain MFPP status and MFPP reimbursement does not improve. Most of us do not have big financial backings. We do not have large reserves with which we can subsidize state-insured clients. This is where our sense of urgency is coming from. Most of the family planning providers in this system are made up of small clinics that are locally based that grew up because there was a neighborhood need or something identified in a county. We're not big players. Most of us are quite small players, but we're crucial to the maintenance of family planning efforts in the state of Minnesota. And we will be able to not sustain our operations if MFPP is our major source of money. MFPP needs to be seen as a companion to the state family planning special project grants. Family planning special project grants allow a clinic to keep the lights on, to sustain operations and serve those not eligible under this waiver program, such as men needing an STD test and treatment, or someone making one penny over the allowed 200% of poverty, which, by the way, I believe is about $9.70 an hour. With the stated goal of reducing government costs resulting from unintended pregnancies, it is imperative that all of the objectives in Senate File 184 be approved. In the early 1990s, MDH estimated that the state would need $25 million a year to meet need for those eligible for subsidized family planning services. We never got more than $5 million a year. Now we've backslid to a little less than $4 million a year. So we are desperately needing money be infused into this system to make sure that the system is sustained and can grow to meet the need. Working together, MFPP and the state family planning special projects can be steps in the direction of really addressing need in Minnesota. Thank you for your time and your support of this vital bill.
Thank you, Mrs. Labor. Are there any questions for Senator Dole?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the reimbursements. Now, is that through medical assistance?
Correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm looking
Senator
at
Dole.
Section 3 saying that you want a payment rates for the family planning services shall be increased by 25%, and yet you're saying you're 37 to 70% is what you need.
It's what we need, but, you know, you try to get what you think you can get.
Okay.
If you had a settle-up program where I could come to you at the end of the year for these people and say, this is what it really cost me, would you give me the difference? I'd be thrilled.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Follow-up then is that with a 25% increase, how far does that get you down the road? Another year, another 2 years?
It depends on my ability to raise money from the private sector, okay. Is what it really depends on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Labor. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I think that points out one of the issues here, that these clinics are nonprofit organizations struggling to find the money as well as provide the services, and when they're only serving about half, a little less than half, the people who need it. For a cost-saving program like this, it would do so much to save MA and MFIP costs. I think they were pushed not to do so, but again, Family Tree is a bigger one of the community clinics in St. Paul, and they and all of the clinics are struggling, and I think if we want to keep their doors open, we have to take this very seriously. So I have Cindy Rastad from Otter Tail and Wadena Community Action Council.
Thank you. Welcome, Mrs. Rastad. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, My name is Cindy Rasted, and I'm a registered nurse. And for the past 18 years, I've worked at the Family Planning Program at the Ottertail-Wadena Community Action Council. It's a CAP agency in New York Mills. I came down here today to share with you the reasons that I hope that you support the Senate File 184, the Prevention First Bill. Our program serves women and families in Ottertail, Grant, Stevens, Pope, Traverse, Wadena, Todd, and Cass counties. We have 10 clinics. 8 of those are mobile, where we actually go into the community, and 2 of those are freestanding clinics. One is in Perm, and our largest one that we have is in Fergus Falls. We cover an amazing 8,000 square miles of rural Minnesota. And the state's Family Planning Special Project Grant is vital for our ability to provide family planning services. Most of our patients are low income. Lots of them don't even have cars. There is a significant lack of public transportation in these counties, and the result of that is access to high-quality, confidential reproductive health care is an anomaly for many of the women and families that we see in our clinics. Reaching our patients is one of the most challenging aspects of our program, and the FPSP money allows us to open our clinics, and it also enables us to provide public information and outreach activities for over 3,000 individuals in these small communities. To put it simply, without the state's FPSP grant, we would not be able to have family planning in rural Minnesota as we do right now. The recent implemented Medicaid waiver will not only does not support the services we provide in these small communities. While we're pleased that the Medicaid waiver expands access to family planning services, the reimbursement rate is really only about 35% of our actual cost. And every time we see a patient, we actually lose money. This isn't sustainable. Lastly, and very important, please allow me to express my strong support for the provision of the bill that would allow a registered nurse to dispense oral contraceptives. As you may know, under the current law, only advanced nurse practitioners, MDs, certified nurse midwives, or physician assistants may dispense oral contraceptives. For us, this is very expensive and unnecessary. It's a limitation for a registered nurses working in the family planning clinics. We struggle every year to have enough money to hire our nurses, doctors, and other staff. The salaries that we offer are not competitive with the area nursing homes and the medical private sector. In most of our clinics, we can only afford to have an advanced nurse practitioner, MD, or a physician or certified nurse midwife in just a half a day to one day per month in some of our clinics. So it causes a problem when a patient comes in for nursing support and contraceptive refill. Our mission at Ottertail-Wadena Community Action Council is to provide high-quality health care to women and families, regardless of their ability to pay, and we gladly do that. But we do seek assistance in helping us keep our doors open by increasing funding for family planning special projects, raising the Medicaid reimbursement rate for family planning services, and by allowing a registered nurse to dispense oral contraceptives. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Rasted? Thank you. Senator Marty.
Two more brief witnesses, Mary Ho and Gail Kulik. Mary's from Rice County Public Health Division.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Ho. I'm the Public Health Director for Rice County. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 184, and I'm representing the Local Public Health Association and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Since 1988, Rice County has administered a Family Planning Special Project Grant from the Minnesota Department of Health. Our project offers public information and outreach, and also contracts with local clinics to provide family planning examinations and contraceptive services for low-income women. Our project serves over 300 low-income women each year from throughout Rice County, and typically no more than one person in any calendar year on the program reports an unintended pregnancy. Project funding is particularly directed toward reaching people with educational, language, disability, and other barriers to using contraceptive services. For the past several years, Rice County Public Health has closely followed efforts by the Minnesota Department of Human Services to obtain and implement the Family Medical Assistance Waiver that would provide coverage for certain low-income women in need of family planning services. Once the program was approved and implemented, we thought that the need for examinations and contraceptives funded through our family planning special project would decrease, and staff would be able to concentrate most of their efforts on educating the public about the program, assisting with enrollment, and providing community-based outreach regarding family planning. As you know, the Minnesota Family Planning Program waiver was approved by the federal government in 2004. In 2006, the Minnesota Department of Human Services initiated provider training on how to screen patients for eligibility and how to bill for services. Rice County Public Health also began to work with our contracted providers in anticipation of their serving patients through the program, and we also started to distribute enrollment forms. This was done with the knowledge that funding for family planning special project grants in Minnesota would be reduced by approximately 50% for the fiscal year beginning July 1st, 2007. Our experience in working with our contracted clinics in Rice County, however, and this is occurring in other parts of Minnesota also, is that providers, even those that accept medical assistance as a form of payment for services, are not universally agreeing to serve women who are enrolled in the Minnesota Family Planning Program. Even fewer are willing to go through the process of screening women for presumptive eligibility for services. In Rice County, for example, our agency contracts with four clinics for family planning services. Only one has agreed to screen for presumptive eligibility and accept the family planning program card for payment. Two of the clinics will neither screen for presumptive eligibility nor bill the Minnesota Family Planning Program, and the fourth has said it will probably bill the waiver for services, but will not screen for presumptive eligibility. Thus, I believe that low-income women will continue, at least into the near future, to rely heavily on services funded through family planning special project grants. While I believe it's possible for the Minnesota Department of Human Services to work successfully with local clinics and the large care systems in Minnesota to assure that women who enroll in the Minnesota Family Planning Program will be able to access family planning services, I do urge the committee to support elimination of the planned decrease in family planning funding scheduled to take place July 1st, 2007, and in turn to support the $8 million appropriation included in Senate File 184. The decrease in funding was intended to occur when the Minnesota Family Planning Program is fully implemented, and it's clear to me and to others in the associations that I represent that full implementation has not occurred and will not be in place by July 1st, 2007. I believe the waiver program is an excellent opportunity for low-income women across Minnesota to have access to a comprehensive set of reproductive health benefits, but that more time is needed for the public to learn about the program, for women to enroll, and for providers and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to work together to ensure that the program is accepted as a source of reimbursement. And I just have a, this is a memo we had gotten from a DHS program. It was written at the end of January, and at the end of it, it says, it's talking about the waiver program. Most providers have not heard of the program and are denying services to people with coverage because they don't understand this is an MA program. Please let your providers know about this program. And they give some links for information. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ho. Are there any questions for the witness? Thank you. Senator Marty.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Ms. Kulik. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Gail Kulik-Jackson, and I'm from Mille Lacs County, Minnesota. And I'm here as a volunteer for Rum River Health Services, Inc., and the Rum River Women's Health Project. I was a founding board member and I've been a volunteer for 20 years there. The funding is vitally important to keep our doors open, and we have been struggling to do so in the face of huge cuts from $64,000 in funding to $25,000, forcing us to close some clinic sites. I'd like to put a real person behind some of this testimony today who has written a letter and asked me to read it. And it's brief, but it really shows the impact that keeping our doors open can have for women in rural Minnesota. A few years ago, a pap smear paid for by Family Planning Special Project Services saved my life. I was a small business owner, a part-time college student, and the single parent of one child. I could not afford health insurance for myself and had put off a pap smear for 7 years. I learned about Rum River Women's Health Project and was able to access the exam and pap smear I knew I needed. I was shocked and scared when I learned that I had stage 4 cervical cancer. With the help of Medicaid, I was able to get life-saving surgery at the University of Minnesota Hospital. I had to close my business, but I managed to get off welfare, finish college, and get a master's degree. I was able to finish raising my child and be present at her wedding last year. I am now a social worker, assisting women in giving birth to healthy babies by helping them stay sober during their pregnancies. I don't know where I would be today if it had not been for the Family Planning Special Project Program in Princeton, Minnesota. Sincerely, Susan Peterson. And while 1115 waiver pays for pap smears, the FPSP funds keep our doors open. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Golick. Senator.
Madam Chair, that's all the witnesses I have. I wanted to stress that we often have debates about the abortion issue, and again, according to the Department of Human Services, about half of all unintended pregnancies in Minnesota end in abortion. And I think this is one of those issues that can bring both sides together in working to prevent unintended pregnancies. This is, again, big cost savings for the state. It's the right thing to do for these families who need the services. These are very low-income people in many cases who are desperately needing the help. And these clinics are struggling to keep their doors open. And so I just wanted to make sure we stress that. And I have no more witnesses, and I don't know if anyone wanted to testify with concerns about the bill, but I'd like to move the bill when you're ready for it.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Is there anyone in the audience who wish to testify? Are there any questions for Senator Marty from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I just for my understanding on Section 6, I don't, I guess, could you explain to me the Medicaid demonstration project and the expansion that you're looking for?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we actually took out Section 6. That was one of the problems with that is that right now if somebody comes in both for a sexually transmitted infection to get medical testing and for contraception, if they come in there saying I need to be tested for infection, they don't get reimbursed for the family planning services. This was going to say they should, but the federal government is saying that the federal government is saying they're not going to allow it or use for such purposes, so we're removing that section from the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Fishback.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty. In the spirit of consistency, I was wondering if you would look at an oral amendment to delete lines 111 through 121, which is the purpose section.
Madam Chair, Senator Fishbach is very consistent in that, and I'm not surprised you'll make that motion.
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to make that motion then, and I guess it's up to Senator Marty if he and Madam Chair, Senator Marty, there are some figures in here too that would quickly become, you know, out of date. If you need convincing, that
Madam Chair, Senator this would Marty. Not be codified, but I'm not opposed to the amendment.
Okay, Senator Fishback, do you want to present your amendment?
Yeah. Madam Chair,
go ahead.
It would delete lines 111, page 1, line 11 through line 21.
Okay, all of those in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Senator Marty.
If there are no further amendments, I'll move that Senate File 184 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. Are there any comments on that motion? If not, all of those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I don't know who the next author is who's here.
We move on to Senate File 559, Family Stabilization Services. Senator Berglund?
No, is she around?
She's not here right now.
Okay.
Not Senator Berglund, so I think he has a
okay. Deal. So we're going to review Senate File 371, expanding eligibility for chemical dependency treatment. Senator Prednisolan.
Yep.
Oh.
Welcome,
you, Madam Chair.
Senator Solomon. Please
first,
go
I'd
ahead
like
and
to
introduce.
Thank you for allowing me to present this bill today. We all know the negative impact of chemical dependency on our communities. Moreover, we know that chemical dependency treatment can be expensive and just out of reach for those struggling to make ends meet. At current levels, all too often, working people who want to get into a treatment program cannot do so because they have an income, however modest. Sadly, it is only after 2 or 3 months of suffering and once they've lost their job due to their addiction that chemical dependency counselors are able to admit these people to treatment. Senate File 371 opposes to expand the eligibility requirements, or proposes to expand the eligibility requirements to meet the needs of this population by expanding the scope of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to include those whose income is at or below 165% of the federal poverty guidelines. This fund was originally created in 1988 to fund cost-effective chemical dependency treatment services for Minnesotans who met certain financial and clinical criteria. When the program was started, 3 separate tiers of eligibility were created to determine assistance. Now only Tier 1 is funded. Tier 2 was designed to cover entitlement to 60% of the statewide median income. It primarily covers minors, pregnant women, and adults with children. Between 2000 and 2002, the Tier 2 coverage fluctuated and was eventually defunded in fiscal year 2004. We are asking to raise the income eligibility standard for Tier 1 eligibility to 165% of poverty. And today I am pleased to be joined by Bob Nelson, President-elect of the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health, and Ellie Skelton, Director of Wayside House Treatment Center. They will testify on why this legislation is needed. Mr. Nelson will be testifying first.
Thank you, Senator Solomon. Mr. Nelson, could you please introduce yourself?
Madam Chair and Senators, Bob Nelson, President-elect of the MARCH Association. The MARCH organization is an organization born about a decade ago of approximately 14 organizations that had represented chemical dependency. We've all come together under one umbrella to do a better job of representing the field of chemical dependency. And because of the inherent shame and issues that when people come forward and admit that they have a chemical use problem, lots of times we are advocates for our clients. We have about 1,000 members spread all over the state of Minnesota. That my guess is that there are chemical dependency counselors in each and every one of your districts. And we have about 45 organizations, agency members of the MARCH Association. We're spread across the state of Minnesota. We've been active in bringing this measure forward because it's good policy for the state of Minnesota. There are many people who are suffering from the chronic disease of chemical dependency. Chemical dependency touches every major issue of our society and the most expensive issues we face. From my work as a detox counselor in the past, I can tell you there are people who are working, who would readily seek treatment, as Senator Solon said, but they just don't have the wherewithal to be able to do it until such time as they lose their job, quit, and then many times they also lose their place to live, and that requires us to fund a more expensive form of treatment, including housing. I would encourage you to think seriously about that. This will result in an increase of about 1,576 persons admitted to treatment in fiscal year 08. 1,975 people in 2009 and 10. While the expansion of this eligibility adds less than 2,000 persons per year to those eligible entering treatment, I would encourage you to remember that each one of those chemically dependent persons affects 10 other people. And when they can't get help, those other people are suffering also. Some specific areas are affected. When you're looking at costs, child out of home placement, social services, law enforcement, 80% of police calls have to do with people being under the influence. Employers who lose good employees as persons who do not qualify until they quit or get fired from their jobs. Lots of times these persons must participate in treatment programs that are far from their homes and less effective than being based in the community. Health care is another issue that's greatly affected. Unreimbursed medical care, emergency rooms, and more lengthy hospital stays when people. Families are not funded. Families are affected when males are not funded, who are the fathers of children. Okay? I encourage you to remember that. Lots of times when we put pregnant women and women with children into treatment, we leave them with the option of being a single parent or being in a relationship with somebody that can't get some help even if they want to. So I would encourage you to vote yes and pass this bill on. A couple other areas, schools. I would like to point out that we have had some success on the meth, and that has come because we have all worked together. So I would encourage you to pass this bill out, and that's it.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Melson. Senator Olson, you're next with.
Hi, my name is Ellie Skelton, and I'm from the Wayside House. I'm the executive director. Thank you for this opportunity to present to the committee. Wayside House is a nonprofit chemical dependency treatment center located in St. Louis Park. Our mission is to help chemically dependent women establish healthy lifestyles, personal potential, and become productive citizens by providing treatment, housing, and social services. In 2006, we worked with over 200 women who were in need of chemical dependency treatment. The most frequently abused drugs were reported as crack cocaine, alcohol, and methamphetamine. Of the women who completed treatment in 2006, 74% earned less than $10,000 in the previous year, and 71% were assessed with below ninth grade reading and math levels. At the current rate of Tier 1 funding, 100% of poverty, who are we missing? I've brought one such example of who currently is not receiving treatment. Linda is a 29-year-old woman with two children. She works temporary office jobs and earns $12 to $15 an hour depending on the job. She likes the flexibility of the temporary work because she's able to be home on school release days and holidays with her kids. She has been a recreational drug user and occasional binge alcohol drinker for the past 10 years. In the past year, she began dating a man who has a history of drug abuse. While they have been careful not to use drugs in front of the children, her drug use has begun to affect her lives in many ways. She's been missing more work, and she is 2 months behind on her rent. She stopped paying her Minnesota Care premium, and she is no longer covered, and neither are her children, for health care. Linda's mom often watches Linda's children on the weekends when Linda is partying with her boyfriend. These weekends have begun to stretch into 3 and 4 days. Linda's temporary employer has expressed concern about Linda's pattern of absences. When Linda forgets her daughter's birthday and has a physical altercation with her boyfriend, she decides to seek help. She has a Rule 25 assessment, and although she clinically meets the criteria for inpatient care, there is no treatment eligibility for her because of her income. By increasing Tier 1 funding to 165% of poverty, Linda would be eligible for treatment now. What are the effects of not treating Linda? Without treatment, Linda's life would continue a downward spiral. Child Protective Services could get involved. She could get evicted, lose her job, and end up couch hopping or in a family shelter. These costs are damaging for Linda's children and for Linda. At this point, when Linda has no income, she would be eligible for treatment, but would have paid a much higher cost. Also, Linda's children would have paid a higher cost. Right now, 100% of poverty for a family of three would be $17,000. We're asking to increase it to 165%, which would increase that threshold up to families of three to $28,330. That would be someone making an average wage full-time work of $13.62. A lot of times when people are working low-wage jobs, they either have inadequate insurance or no insurance, or insurance that doesn't cover chemical dependency treatment. Thank you for your consideration, and thank you to Senator Prettner-Solin for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Skelton. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill. I would move that Senate File 371 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Division.
Is there discussion of that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Berglund.
When does she have two bills?
Chair Brogan, you can start with SIN file 310. Or?
Yes, I think we will because Dr. McRaymon, this is a difficult time.
It came out wrong.
Take it so we can leave. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 310 is a bill that expands the definition of chemically dependent person for the purposes of our mandated reporting law to include a pregnant woman who is engaged in habitual or excessive use of alcohol or THC, the mind-altering component of marijuana. The bill would require a mandated reporter to report to the local welfare agency if a pregnant woman is habitually or excessively using these two chemicals. And then it repeals the existing prenatal exposure to alcohol abuse law. I think if we can pass this bill, it will do a lot to protect unborn children from the devastating things that can happen to them when their mother is using these chemicals while pregnant. I think this will go a long way to helping to prevent fetal alcohol syndrome or spectrum disorder. I'd like to call on Dr. Michael Brayman to testify on behalf of the bill now.
Mr. Brayman, welcome to the
and
committee.
We have the handouts if somebody could
we
come
will
and
pick
get
them up.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Berglund. My comments are approximately 3 to 4 minutes in length, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions for you either during or after. My name is Michael Brayman. I'm the one who wrote the language in Senate file number 310. I've been working on this for the last couple of years and secured the endorsements for it from the Johnson Institute, the National Association of Addiction Professionals, and the Minnesota Association of Treatment Programs. I'm also the one who prepared the comments in support of the legislation that are being distributed to you at this time. I have my, by way of background, I have my Bachelor's of Arts degree from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, my Juris Doctorate from DePaul University College of Law in Chicago, Illinois. I practiced law in the Twin Cities for 20 years, and I'm still licensed as a lawyer. In addition, I have my Master's of Arts degree in Addiction Counseling from Hazelden's Graduate School of Addiction Studies. I'm a licensed alcohol and drug counselor at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview, where I counsel adult chemical addicts. However, this legislation has been pursued wholly apart from my employment. This bill proposes to do four things. First, it proposes to expand, as Senator Berglund said, the definition of a chemically dependent person under Minnesota's civil commitment statute to include pregnant women who are habitually or excessively using alcohol or marijuana. The medical reasons for this are clear, undisputed, and compelling, and they have been included in your materials. The statute, or the proposed statute, also seeks to require persons who are already mandated reporters to report to the local welfare agency women who are pregnant who are habitually or excessively using alcohol or THC, just as they're required to do now with pregnant women who are habitually or excessively using other chemicals such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and the like. Third, it requires the local welfare agencies upon receipt of the report to evaluate the situation, refer the woman for an assessment if appropriate, refer her for prenatal care, refer her for chemical dependency treatment, or take such other action as is required in the situation. So this is not criminalizing anything. This is referring women for assessment and for chemical dependency help if they need it, just as the situation exists now for other chemicals that pregnant women may be using that are controlled substances. Last, it repeals the permissive reporting statute that exists as it relates to alcohol, as, at least in my opinion, and those of the supporters of this legislation, it is inadequate at this time. Now, I don't know if I'll have the I won't have the opportunity to come back, so I just want to address briefly the two concerns I've heard raised about this legislation. The first concern is that this legislation would deter women from seeking prenatal care. My response to that is that that is a totally speculative concern, and what is not speculative are the catastrophic effects on children with fetal alcohol syndrome disorders in terms of the emotional consequences, the behavioral problems, the cognitive problems. And furthermore, if that is really the position of the critics, then what I suggest that they should be doing is seeking a repeal of the mandatory reporting statute as it relates to pregnant women who are consuming other mood-altering chemicals. And second, the other criticism I've heard is that there's not statistical evidence to suggest that this type of statute would work. And my response to that is there's not statistical evidence to suggest it won't work. And we're not going to know unless we try. And this is a huge problem. And what we know is that the status quo is not acceptable and something different needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brink. I did have a question because I remember when the prenatal exposure to alcohol abuse reporting, the permissive language was put in effect, and that was the concern about scaring pregnant women away from, they wouldn't get any prenatal care because they were afraid of that. And your argument is we already do it for other drugs, and if that doesn't scare them away from coming back, why would alcohol or marijuana?
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brahman, is that the correct pronunciation?
Close, Brahman.
Brahman. I'm wondering, does THC and alcohol now cover, when added to the other classifications, include all classifications of addictive drugs? Or why are we just adding those two?
Because they're prevalent, because they need, I can't think of another category that would need to be added at this time. I assess persons 4 to 6 times a week. Alcohol and cannabis are the medical reasons for that are so obvious that that's why I chose to add them. It's a big gap, in at least in my view of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Solon, I know that the OxyContin-type drugs were added last session. I'm not aware of any others that aren't included.
Okay.
If these would be included.
Too addictive for me.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Brahman, thank you for your testimony. A couple of things. We did hear testimony in this committee last week that THC was a totally benign substance and that there's no harm to people who use it. I'm just wondering, and maybe that's more a question for the committee, that why we would want to put this in the category of chemical of a danger when we heard testimony last week that said that there is no danger to anybody to use cannabis, particularly if it's self-prescribed, but that's maybe a separate point. My question, though, on your bill is the expanding the definition of chemically dependent person, is it not the case today that a pregnant woman who is using alcohol excessively would not be considered chemically dependent? I'm just unclear of what your bill is doing. I would, my own thought, and I'm not a professional, would be that if I'm treating a patient that has an alcohol problem, I would certainly consider that person chemically dependent. What does this do that is different?
Under the current Mr. Chairman, Senator, under the current legislation, there is no requirement that there be mandated reporting for women who are abusing alcohol.
And Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Brahman, so is the concern that there are people that are seeing pregnant women that are using alcohol and they're not doing any kind of taking any steps to try to address that? Is that the
correct? There is. The statute says in about three different ways that no reporting is necessary for women who are abusing alcohol. And furthermore, the bar for the definition of abusing alcohol is so incredibly high that it misses a vast number of people.
And finally, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Brahman, so if this becomes reportable then, and help me out a little bit, I'm new to the committee and I don't know all the details of the reporting and what that so what is the effect of the reporting then? A person is compelled or required under this law to report, and then what does that trigger?
It triggers a Mr. Chairman, Senator, it triggers a review by a local welfare agency if it passes the initial screening test of who's ever receiving the call. So a call will go into the local welfare agency. Whoever receives the call will determine whether or not it rises to a level that warrants further investigation. If it does, that person, the pregnant woman, will be evaluated, and the appropriate recommendation will be made, either nothing, a referral to prenatal care, a referral for an assessment, or a referral for chemical dependency treatment.
Okay. Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brayman, just expanding a little bit on Senator Hahn's questioning. In my own practice, I've seen too many children who are suffering the effects of FAS or parents who are addicted to addictive drugs. And these children are damaged severely. I'm seeing the parents. Is there anything further we can do to protect those? I mean, will this require that the woman receive some type of treatment, or does it only make a referral? Is there anything that can actually be done to protect the unborn child?
As I understand the statute as it exists now and as it would continue to exist under this legislation, if the woman did not follow the guidelines of the referral, civil commitment proceedings to treatment could be undertaken, which, at least in my experience, may be stayed, assuming she follows through on the commitment. But the stick, if you will, would be the threat of civil commitment or commitment if the woman did not follow through on the recommendation.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other question, Mr. Brayman. And it goes back, I guess, to the inclusion of THC substances in this. In your practice or in your work, are you familiar with people who have been harmed by using THC?
When you say people, Mr. Chairman, Senator, when you say people, who are you talking about?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, as I understand the purpose of the bill, what we're saying is that people who have habitually used certain substances, of which we're adding to the list, alcohol and THC products or derivatives, and particularly as it deals with pregnant women, which I would imagine then there would be some negative impact to an unborn child if a pregnant mother was using THC. And I'm just wondering if you are familiar with any instances where there has been any harm caused by using this drug. And I say that because we heard very long, detailed testimony last week about how benign THC was, and I'm wondering why, if that's the case, we would bother to put it into a bill and say that it's a potential danger.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I don't think that that testimony included a discussion of the effects of on an unborn fetus or the use by a pregnant woman. And I think, even a moderate amount of use of alcohol might not harm an individual, but it could harm an unborn fetus.
And Mr. Chairman,
so it's a different situation when a woman is pregnant.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I agree, but the bill refers to not just pregnant women, but generally defining chemical dependent person to include these things. And all I'm trying to understand is whether there is that danger, and if so, does that have any bearing on the things we did last week, or if what we did last week is correct, then maybe we shouldn't have this in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I'm not the author of last week's bill, and so I don't especially appreciate being put in a position here to defend last week's bill. What I can say to you is that this bill's talking about excessive use, and I'm not sure that bill was talking about excessive use.
And Senator Hahn, two other points on this. One is in lines 1.16. It's talking about pregnant women who use THC or alcohol, and the only purpose for Section 1, I believe, is for the civil commitment laws. You wouldn't be committing somebody for use of alcohol unless they were pregnant and you couldn't stop them from using it because of the concern for impact on the fetus. Mr. Brayman, I had one more question about the civil commitments of people who, in the existing pregnant women who have used any of the controlled substances that are currently in the law. Do you know of cases where pregnant women have been committed, civilly committed for that because they could not stop continuing use on their own?
I personally don't know of examples, but I certainly have had persons who have been civilly committed as my clients, patients, if you will, and generally the way it works is the person will be referred to treatment and the commitment will be stayed pending completion of treatment, and the level of treatment will, and that's on an outpatient basis, and if outpatient chemical dependency treatment has been shown to have failed or would not be appropriate in a particular situation, then the referral, for example, has been to Anoka State Hospital or some other longer care facility. So that may be, for example, a woman or a man, but since we're talking about women, a woman who just simply cannot stay clean while they're going through outpatient treatment, and so a higher level of care would be recommended.
I just wondered, maybe Senator Berglund, you know, if there are pregnant women who have been civilly committed.
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't, but I do know of numerous programs that work with people who are pregnant and abusing chemicals who have told me that this would be an enormous help if they could have this tool. You know, the commitment doesn't need to take place if the threat of commitment is there, oftentimes.
I realize that a lot of people will go through treatment because of the threat is there. Senator Lynch.
Senator Marty, Senator Berglund, just to clarify for me, so I think you just hit it, clarified it for me, Senator Berglund. The purpose of this is just to make this more clear in the language, I guess. So, because as I read it, it does talk about the use of alcohol and as in the definition of chemically dependent, but you're suggesting that the additional language here provides further support for those affected agencies?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, today a woman may not be reported to the local welfare agency, so she may never be offered services or may never be, signed up for a chemical dependency program. Under this bill, that would happen. Then if she is refusing to follow through with the chemical dependency program, there would be an ability to have her committed until the time that her child is born.
And Senator Marty, Senator Berglund, if I may. And then just a technical sort of question on page 1, line 17, and line 23. One time we use the word controlled, and one time we don't use the word controlled, and I wondered if that meant anything. That's line 17 and line 23. My question surrounding the use of the word controlled or not.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, it's because in the first part of the bill we're talking about every one of the substances. We're referring to it. On the second line, we're not. We're just talking about the mass controlled substances.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, I am very supportive of this language. I think it's very important. I'm a little concerned about the follow-up. After we report, it just seems to me that we're going to get a high increase of reports about alcohol particularly. And do you feel that we have the capacity to deal with those patients and these individuals, and that we have in Minnesota enough programs in place to help pregnant women deal with this issue? So I'm very happy that this is the first step we have to take, but I'm concerned about the follow-up. What can the counties do to provide services to pregnant women, particularly with alcohol, because we'll have a high number of women dealing with this issue.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, I believe that this will be a priority. Most people have become aware of the fact that a child that's born with fetal alcohol syndrome can cost $2 million a year. Mm. And so the counties oftentimes end up footing those costs without assistance from the state. So I think that this will be a high priority for the counties to make sure these folks are getting into treatment programs and that the payment for those programs is available.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first one is on the repealer. And it's there's quite a large section that is being repealed and replaced by the changes here in this bill. And in the section that's being repealed, it looks like there are requirements for people in the household to voluntarily report and some other things. And has this just become obsolete? And can you give me more information on the repealer part?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, this statute that's being repealed is a voluntary reporting law. So when we go to a mandatory reporting law, then the voluntary reporting law would be obsolete.
Okay, I got it.
Anybody included in this law that's not included in the previous law could still already voluntarily report. They don't need a law to tell them they can voluntarily do so.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, one last question. Who is the local welfare agency these days? Would that be the county?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, yes.
Is that, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, is that still the term of art? At some point, shouldn't we be changing that to something more current as well? Probably all throughout statute.
It is.
It's fine.
It's throughout the statute, so we're just using that term because that is what is in the statutes. I think that would be a different project if you want to change it.
I think a big one, yeah.
And Senator Higgins, on the part, like some of the other language in the repealed language, talks about making a report to the welfare agency if the person fails to follow through, since her bill is having the report right away. I think that's why so much language is being repealed, because we're doing it all at once.
Okay, thank you.
Is there further questions or discussion? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 310 be recommended to pass and
sent to the floor.
Goes to the floor. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Berglund and Mr. Brayman. The pictures of the brain size at 6 months is impressive, unfortunate, impressive difference. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
We have Senator Berglund, you want to take up your other bill? Now we'll get back to the other chemical dependency bill after this one.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate File 559 is a bill that I've been working on for a number of years. I served on the task force of the National Conference of State Legislators that was trying to influence the federal government on the changes that they were anticipating to the TANF law regarding work participation. We ended up not being very successful in a lot of the things that we were trying to get them to do, and they ended up including TANF work participation requirements in the reauthorization of TANF, which was part of the Budget Balancing Act at the federal level.
Excuse me for a second. Members of the committee, if you can't find 559, it may be in your packets because it was the bill left over from earlier.
We now have work participation requirements that are very difficult, and I will explain as I go through the bill some of the reasons that they're difficult. But just so you understand one thing, a two-parent family making $650 an hour, working 20 hours a week, which is the federal requirement, would no longer be on our MFIP program. So they would not be able to be counted then as a participant that would meet the work participation standard. So it's kind of the whole thing becomes kind of a catch-22. You can't get there from here. It's like the guy who doesn't have the token to get off the bus. So this bill is designed to do a number of things to help us be able to meet those work participation requirements. If we do not meet those work participation requirements, We have about $13.5 million of federal TANF funds that are at stake that we can be penalized. The reporting period for the first year of compliance started last October. So I've had bills. I've been trying to get them passed. I have not been able to get the House or the executive branch to take these bills seriously. Hopefully this year we're going to take a bill seriously. So then let me just go through the bill, Mr. Chairman. There are several provisions that in the bill that create a family stabilization services. These services would be available to people that the counties determine are in need of specific services before they actually could be expected to be applying for or participating in a work activity. An example would be chemical dependency treatment. Another example might be immigrants who have come to the United States but do not yet speak English. And teaching them how to speak English as a second language does not meet the work participation requirements at the federal level. So the bill creates the family stabilization services and allows participants in that stabilization service to get child care assistance. In Section 3, there was a provision added to the new federal law that says, broadens the categories of expenditures at the state level that can be considered maintenance of effort, and that includes expenditures in the higher education area. And there's a provision in the law that can change the formula for states if they are contributing more maintenance of effort monies. We did not apply to get that exemption for the first year because our state statutes explicitly state how the Human Services Department must count maintenance of effort dollars. So this provision gives them more flexibility to change the maintenance of effort in our state plan without requiring legislative approval. This provision alone can reduce the number of people you have to have in the work participation rate by a third. So it's an important provision for us, especially in the beginning of this program, to be able to take advantage of. We also then have some provisions in here that will make it a little bit more flexible for people to use an automobile for transportation in the MFIP program. We are told, especially by folks in the rural areas, that lack of transportation is one of the biggest barriers that families face in being able to get or keep a job. And being that that is one of the things that is the main part of the work participation requirements, we are striking the vehicle loan value cap in the bill. Then we have another provision in the bill, and we have addressed it in two ways, and eventually we have to decide maybe how to combine these or which way to go. But another way of being able to get a higher work participation rate is by being able to count people that otherwise are leaving the program. They're working the number of hours that are required by the federal government, but today they're not in the program. And if there's a way we can count them longer, then we can get our work participation rate up. And there are two ways this bill does that. One, by raising the existing exit level. And the second way in the bill is by giving people bonuses, $100 a month bonuses. In either case, we would want to do this in a way that does not keep that individual family's clock ticking because there is a five-year limit on the time people can be in the program. So the idea here is to use state maintenance of effort dollars only. The Section 8 requires an MFIP household to report every 6 months instead of monthly. This will reduce some of the bureaucracy in the program because other provisions certainly do increase the bureaucracy in the program.
Senator Berglund, in Section 7, what were you replacing the 115 with?
We haven't decided. We're getting fiscal notes at various levels.
Okay.
Then in Section 10, we're adding language that will allow a job counselor to allow participants who are participating in at least 20 hours of work activities to also participate in training activities in order to meet the federally hourly participation rates. Currently, one of the things that the federal law does do that is helpful is it allows people in the program for the first year to be involved in education and training and to have that count as work activity. After the first year, that activity does not count any longer. So we are removing here the requirement that MFIT participants work at least 20 hours per week in order to be in a post-secondary or training program so that we can take advantage of that provision for more people during the first year of the program. We clarify the number of hours of work activity, 30 hours per week for single-parent families with children. Single-parent families with no children under the age of 6 and 20 hours a week for children in the family under the age of 6. Family stabilization services then that are created in the bill would not really change the program activities very much. It's a program for people that are deemed by the county not able to work 20 or 30 hours a week because of other things they need to do to stabilize their family. We do indicate some of the types of people that might be in that category. An MFIT participant who is age 60 or older or is suffering from illness or incapacity expected to last 30 days or more, or who is needed at home to care for an ill or incapacitated family member, is unlikely to benefit from diversionary work, is an individual eligible for the hardship extension, or who is applying for supplemental security income or Social Security disability income. Then there are a number of things in the bill that talk about things that will be done to make sure these folks are getting the services they need so that when they are ready, they can be moved into the regular MFIT program where then they would be expected to work the 20 or 30 hours a week. As I said earlier, the bill does also look at the strategy of giving a monthly work participation bonus to people that are meeting the work participation requirements so we can count people that otherwise would not be in the program any longer. This will, I think, do two things. One, it will help us increase our work participation rate, and it also will help these families from returning to the program. We do have a high rate of returns of people that have left the program but need to come back, and this extra income would help them be able to be more stable when they leave the program. Section 19 of the bill allows the innovative funds to be provided to counties and tribes as an incentive to those counties and tribes to exceed the federal performance. We also then repeal a number of things in the bill, including non-citizens being ineligible for the MFIP food or cash assistance, repeal the MFIP consolidated fund subdivision related to performance-based funds, and also repeal an obsolete report. The bill goes on in Article 2 to establish a grant program for counties to provide supported or subsidized work. This would then, you have 6 weeks you can be in job search, and after that, then only 1 hour a week of job search counts toward your work participation rate. So for someone that might be in an area of the state where employment is hard to find, maybe they've got 15 hours of work, this would allow the county then to provide them with 5 hours of subsidized employment to fill out their 20 hours. If it's an individual that has not been able to obtain any employment, then it would allow the county to refer them to a supported work program where they would be paid a full wage to participate in the program, and the program would have employment activities as well as perhaps training activities and other activities that a participant might need in order to be able to move out of a supported work program and into a full employment program. We have appropriations in the bill. I have two amendments, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to take before we take testimony on the bill. First one is an A3 amendment. First part of this amendment has to do with when participants should be assessed during the course of the MFIP program. The second amendment on page 1, line 14, deletes employment and inserts education. I think it was just an error in the original bill. Then page 1, lines 15 to 19, and page 31, page 2, line 9, incorporate MFIP and DWP into a more specific way of calculating hours and monthly averages. Then we modify eligibility requirements of the new family stabilization program, expanding the number of months that non-citizens could be in the program from 6 months to 12 months. This would parallel the request of the governor's bill. And then also allows people who do not have a plan yet, they've applied to the county, but the county has not had time to get a plan during the first 30 days, for them also to be in the family stabilization program so they don't need to be counted against the work participation requirements. The amendment also then requires that ESL and other skills be provided to people who do not speak English who are in the family stabilization program. We also are in this bill are saying that if counties do not meet the work participation rate during the first year, most of which has already gone by, that they would not be assessed a penalty during that first year. Then we also, in this section on page 2, add the provision that would allow counties to be eligible for funds to pay for supplemental hours of paid work to help fill out a participant's hours that are needed. It also allows opportunity industrial centers to be eligible for work-study grants. We are purchasing work-study grants in this bill because we hope that some people that may be past their first year in the program for whatever reason and are in an education or training program will need then those work study grant hours to make their 20 or 30 hours of work. And then it increases the appropriation to the integrated service projects from $3 million to $6 million for the biennium. That is what they have been receiving up till now. And that, Madam Chair, is the A2 amendment. I would move adoption of the amendment.
Are there any questions for Senator Berglund on her amendment? Then you can move your amendments. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, you said a little bit earlier that taking ESL classes no longer counts as work. So how does the paragraph that starts on 1.26 of the amendment work with that?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, these folks would be in the family stabilization services, and those services would, and the people in that part of the program would be on state-only dollars, and therefore they're not counted in our numerator.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund,
Senator Higgins.
If people are in the program now and taking ESL classes, but they're not progressing at a rate that either they or their county workers are comfortable with, do you envision that they would then move to the family stabilization program, even though they're already enrolled in MFIP now?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the purpose of this bill is to give the counties the opportunities to move people that are in MFIP now. They still would be in MFIP, but they would be in the Family Stabilization Services part of the program. And so the county plan for them might be to be in ESL services. That is their job, to go to those classes. Well, that isn't going to count as work, so then the county could move them into this other part of the program.
And then, Madam Chair, the last Senator question Higginson. I have, do you add funding in here for more ESL classes then? You're doubling the amount of time that they can be in?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, no, the bill doesn't do that, but the bill does provide money for supported work programs, some of which could have English as a second language be a component of that program.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I have a bill that does increase ESL funding at the community education level, and
great.
Maybe this can all work together.
Great. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Berglund, on 12.5, page 12, line 5, a participant who is a non-citizen who has been in the state for 6 or fewer months, how does that address illegal immigrants?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, illegal immigrants are not eligible for the MFIP program.
Thank you. That's the clarification I want.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Berglund, I guess somewhat along the lines of Senator Wergen's question, in your repealer, we're repealing, and I don't remember if this was passed last year, but we have something in law currently that says that if a person is not eligible for federal programs, then they would also not be eligible for Minnesota programs, and we're repealing that. So is the intent of that to say that we would have more generous kinds of qualifications than what the federal guidelines would be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, today we provide food assistance to immigrants that the federal government does not allow federal reimbursement for. I think it's probably an oversight on their part, but repealing that provision is also in the governor's bill. These are mainly elders that are not citizens, but otherwise would be eligible for food assistance.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you. Senator Marty, Senator Berglund, just two comments. One, Senator Berglund, I just wanted to say that I really appreciated the notions in this bill that specifically seek to address some of the administrative costs associated with such programs, and so I think that's a real positive thing to see. And also, I just wanted to comment on the use of post-secondary education as an option for these individuals, because I really believe that educating our public is probably the single most important economic tool we can do in this state at all levels. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, and thank you for that.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one other question, Senator Berglund. You mentioned in part of your testimony with respect to the on page 5, the percent, and that there's a fiscal note. Is there some sense of what the cost of your the provision of this bill would be? Do we have any ballpark?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I don't know. There have been a number of provisions added since last year. We knew how much the bill cost last year. Of course, you know, our total population has changed since last year also, and that always affects the cost of the bill. But I would just remind you that if we don't meet these work participation requirements, we're going to lose $13.5 million of TANF money. And really and truly, I think the emphasis of this bill is to be able to meet those work participation requirements without drastically changing our program, continuing to keep the investment in the word Minnesota Family Investment Program, and to reward people for work in the bill.
You've moved
we
the A3
amendment.
An
amendment, right.
Is there further discussion on the A3 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. A5 amendment.
Right. Mr. Chairman, the A5 amendment, the counties had asked us to remove the word program from the Family Stabilization Services because they didn't want it to look like it was another entire program, and it's not. It's really still part of the MFIP program. It's just a way of counting people for the purposes of this federal act with the use of different money. So we removed the word program throughout. And then we also have made it clear that people that are in the family stabilization services could be served through a job counselor if that's appropriate. So if they're in treatment, then they're going to have a case manager with that program. But for some of these folks, you know, if they're applying for Social Security disability, they don't need a counselor. They just need to have the job counseling agency know that that's what they're doing to keep track of them. And then deletes the term supported work, and because people had an idea that this was limited to the type of supported work that we provide for people with disabilities, and it's not intended to be, so we're going to call it paid transitional work and other supported employment.
Discussion on the A5 amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of witnesses. I'd like to call Jessica Webster and Deborah Schlick to the table to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm the director of the Affirmative Options Coalition. We are a coalition of more than 50 organizations throughout the state of Minnesota, faith networks, nonprofit agencies providing direct service to low-income Minnesotans, and advocacy organizations. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate File 559. And I wanted to hit on a couple of points that reiterate some of the points that Senator Berglund has made. And the first is that the challenge in front of Minnesota is significant. Minnesota is not alone in the challenge. When Congress made the changes to the formula for assessing state performance under the Welfare to Work Block Grant, TANF, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that with these changes in place, 47 out of 50 states are likely to fail to hit the performance target. What it means for the federal government is saving money by penalizing state block grants. What it means for the states, of course, is receiving those penalties. And I wanted to also know that the committee is sure about the detail about the penalties. If we are penalized any amount of TANF block grant funds, under federal law, the state also has to replace those lost federal funds with new state spending. So what we do not get with the penalties is a smaller welfare program. We get a welfare program the state has to put more of its own money into. And I wanted to speak about that measure because it explains a lot of what happens in the bill. The work participation rate is the measure by which the federal government is assessing state performance. The work participation rate is more truly a process measure than an outcome measure. It counts how many hours parents currently on cash assistance are, how many hours they're spending in about 10 activities that the federal government has designated as official work activities. It does not count parents who get jobs that take them off the program. What we believe the public really wants from this program, the state gets no credit for. That is why this bill would propose that we support parents who get earnings with some continued diminished assistance. And that will accomplish two things. It allows the state to get credit for its most successful families, to count those families in the work participation rate. We believe, even more importantly, it goes back to the roots of a research-designed and proven program, the Minnesota Family Investment Program in its pilot stage, and that is that we begin again to use this program to move families out of poverty, and that the state gets the benefits not only of avoiding federal penalties, but actually seeing the 80,000 children who rely on this program move out of the chaos of poverty. And also for that reason, that is why it's important to create the flexibility for the most challenged families on the program. It's a small number of families. The governor estimates about 3,200 families would be in what this bill calls family stabilization services, families who face parents face disabilities or they're raising children with disabilities. And you need to understand under the new federal rules issued this summer, parents would only get credit for up to 6 weeks in mental health treatment or in social services in a year's time. even if the treating practitioner says this is someone who needs ongoing deep treatment, the parent gets no credit for that. Therefore, the state gets no credit. So the purpose of the family stabilization services is not to move families off the work track, but to allow the flexibility at the front line to deliver the services that indeed move families towards work, whether or not those services and activities count in that short list of 10 allowed activities. And then finally, to reiterate about the education training piece, 40% of the parents who turn to cash assistance in Minnesota don't have a high school diploma. It seems it does not serve the families well, it does not serve our state well, and it does not serve our employers well to spend a year or 2 years with those families and have them leave the program with as few skills as they walked in the door with. We think opening up the access to training and education is critical for the long-term success of the families. We appreciate that you're hearing this bill. We very much hope to see your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Ms. Webster.
Mr. Senator Chair, Brooks. If I could, just before Ms. West testifies, Senate counsel has informed me we no longer need Section 4 in the bill, so I would move to delete Section 4.
Senator Berglund moves to delete Section 4 on page 2 and 3. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Webster.
Chairman Marty, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal representation to low-income Minnesotans across the state. We also serve seniors regardless of income. We served 35,000 people last year. This will be the third legislative session that we have supported Senator Berglund in bringing this bill. We hope it will move forward this year, and sadly, we know that we may have not been in this predicament if we had moved quicker on this bill, you know, 3 years ago. But what I just want to talk about briefly today is Minnesota made really significant progress throughout the 90s in moving people to work. So this new challenge before us, it's kind of given us a chance to take a step back and look at who's coming to MFIP. And oversimplified, we see three categories of folks. We see people, a third of the people coming to MFIP have just lost a job. They have some skills and some training, and they won't be on MFIP very long. The second category, as Deborah Schlick mentioned, have very little education and training. However, if we invest in these families and these individuals, they also won't be on MFIP very long. The third category is a category that Legal Aid is very concerned about. It's the state's most vulnerable families. They're families with very significant multiple barriers to employment. And as many of you know, many of these families aren't facing one barrier. They're facing multiple. So it's chemical dependency, mental illness, physical disabilities, contacts with child welfare, children with special needs, and their families that are reaching the time limits in our program, and their families that, unfortunately, they're not helping our work participation rate, and that's why the family stabilization services is so important and why we need to move these families to separate state funds. So by doing that, we very much support that provision of this bill. We think it's crafted well, and we think that this will help us meet the federal work participation rate.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Discussion of the bill?
If there are no questions, then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 559, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Senator Rosen. I think I saw her around.
She just stepped out the back door.
Okay, maybe somebody can. Here she comes. Senator Rosen, welcome to the committee. Senate File 532.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's my pleasure to be before you with Senate File 532. As you know, one of our goals this year is to direct and focus dollars to effective treatment programs. And a proper assessment protocol is very important to the effectiveness and the success of this treatment program. Last year, the Legislative Auditor's Office released a report in February 06 that examined the availability and outcomes of substance abuse treatment in community-based and prison-based settings. Therefore, the recommendations for Senate File 532. I'll just run down real quickly what's in the bill, and I also have Joel Alter, a project manager from the office here, to explain further this bill if you have any questions. But basically, Section 1 specifies who's responsible for doing a chemical use assessment, the circumstances, and the timeline. In that section, subdivision 1, when a person is arrested or taken into custody outside of a person's county of residence, a chemical assessment by that person's county must be completed within the 3 weeks time frame after the first request. If not completed, a county where the person is to be sentenced must complete the assessment. Subdivision 2, if the assessment is required on someone who is on probation or on correctional supervision, the probation officer must be notified. In Subdivision 3, it prohibits the assessor from any direct shared financial interest with the treatment provider unless, and there's two exceptions, the assessor is a specific provider for a specific age, sex, or sexual preference. And number 2, if the county does not employ enough qualified assessors. So there's two exemptions in that one. Section 2 of the bill basically lays out the duties of the Commissioner of Human Services. And there's a long list there, but a few of them that I like is distributing information to the chemical health assessors on best practices, a directory for a chemical dependency treatment program, and number 3, track best practices for monitoring clients' treatment programs. And Section 3, Section 4 is basically reports. Section 3 will, there will be a report which will analyze the maintenance of effort of the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund and look for posting online reviews of placements. And Section 4, the Commissioner of Human Services will report on the progress. So I whipped through that very quickly. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members, I'm out of breath, but it's exactly the direction I think that we should be heading as far as revamping and making sure that our programs have a chance for success. And with the, like I said, Joel Alter is here for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. That's an author's amendment.
Oh, thank you.
Is there any discussion of that amendment? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Alter, did you want to add something or just questions?
Mr. Chair, just a couple of brief comments. As Senator Rosen said, all of the elements of this bill are based on recommendations that were in our report last year. And just to mention a couple of things on the provisions of Section 1 related to persons arrested outside of their home county and contacting probation officers as a part of the assessment process. Both of those are now requirements that are in our DWI statutes. And so this would be to expand and broaden the use of this. We think that makes good sense. And then one other comment regarding the clarification of the conflict of interest. We simply thought that there needed to be some consistency between what the statutes say and what the rules say, and that's the there are different ways that could be accomplished, and this is certainly one of those ways.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Alter, can you talk about the effective date that's on 2.13 and 14? It's all effective July 1st, except for the subdivisions dealing with the financial conflict of interest, which are pushed 2 years out. I'm curious about why we would do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm wondering if it may have to do with the fact that DHS has rules that are taking effect in January of 2009. I'm not sure if that's the reason or not.
Or that damn computer.
Maybe there's someone else that can speak to that.
Perhaps somebody...
anybody else know?
Go ahead, Senator.
The other thought that Senator Solon thought was health match. Maybe that... And that's that computer that I love to complain about.
I don't think
Senator Berglund, that would,
Mr.
Should,
Chairman,
should be up and long
Senator
that.
Higgins, I don't think health match has anything to do with conflict of interest in doing assessments. I mean, it would be saying that if you're the treatment program, you're not assessing your own clients. And so I have no idea why the delay in the date. But
Maybe
I want to thank Senator Rosen for picking up on this bill where Senator Ranum left off last year, and I'm sure it was part of her bill, and I don't know why it was in the bill. But
Mr. Chair, could we find out about it, and if it's
not something we'll have Senator Council look into that and get back to. Yeah.
That we need to, let's move it all to the same date.
Sounds good. Senator Rosen or Mr. Alter, the probation officer contact in the DWI law, don't we also require other collateral contacts, family members or others to for part of the assessment? Is that correct? And if so, do we track the same thing for other non-DWI ones as well? Are we just adding probation officers here? Or?
Mr. Chair, I think this is simply being explicit on probation officers. The current assessment requirements do require collateral contacts, but they aren't explicit about requiring that probation officers be a part of those contacts.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, I would then move Senate File 532 be recommended to pass, and I'm not sure where it needs to be.
It has
referred
to go to Finance.
Okay. Senate File 530, Senator Prettner-Solin moves Senate File 532 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
With that, the committee is adjourned.